Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Michael Steele Podcast. I'm Michael Steele. This has been a tough couple of weeks, and there's a lot on my mind. I know there's a lot on your mind out there, and there's a lot of things that I think we have to put in perspective as we grapple with COVID-19, unemployment in the country now at almost 40 plus million people, and certainly the death of George Floyd, which has rocked not just the United States, but has ricocheted around the world. And I got someone joining us today I'm very excited to talk to about all of this. She is an incredible trendsetter, pacemaker in terms of a lot of these big issues that we grapple with. Angela Rye, a CNN political commentator, CEO of Impact Strategies, a political strategy firm with a cutting-edge approach to achieving clients' goals in the nation's capital and beyond. And she's the host of her own podcast, On One with Angela Rye. And we've got her on my podcast. So I'm happy you dropped by.
It's my pleasure.
Absolutely. Well, I wanted to open up the conversation from a perspective that I thought was pretty interesting. One of the things that has struck me time and time again as these events occurred, whether it's Freddie Gray out of Baltimore or Trayvon Martin, and now with George Floyd, is the surprise that the white community has about how black folks have to approach these things. You know, mm-hmm. I tell people all the time, and I remember the first time I brought it up on Morning Joe, and Eugene Robinson did the same. It's like, look, I had to sit my sons down when they got of age to go out and hang out and, you know, run with their boys and let them know that you can't run the way your white friends run. Because you're going to wind up running away from some cops and a whole lot of mess.
And it's
a moment that I think crystallized for me was Atlanta Mayor Keisha. Yeah, Keisha mm-hmm. Lance. Yes. She had a press conference in which she laid it out. And I want to play just a little bit of that to sort of color how we can get into this conversation. Let's listen to the mayor real quick.
Mm-hmm. I am a mother. I am a mother to 4 black children in America, one of whom is 18 years old. And when I saw the murder of George Floyd, I hurt like a mother would hurt. And on yesterday when I heard there were rumors about violent protests in Atlanta, I did what a mother would do. I called my son and I said, "Where are you?" I said, "I cannot protect you, and black boys shouldn't be out today."
And that was that took me back. How do we process this, Angela? How have you processed this? What is it that we're not getting through to people that we seem to find ourselves over and over again in these situations?
Well, I don't think that it is on us to get through to people. I think that it is on systems of oppression and folks who have benefited from white supremacy and folks who are beneficiaries of white privilege to get it and to shift. We make up, 12% of the United States population.
Right.
And therefore are not in the majority positions of power. And so I don't believe that it is incumbent upon us, nor is it inherently possible for us to do all of the shifting ourselves. I think that it takes a whole lot of willing parties, collaborators. One of my friends tweeted to me when I talked about allies, they said, no, it's co-conspirators. Like, we need to have some people who are truly engaged in wanting to undo a system that has benefited them. And we know that's got to be really tough.
Mm-hmm.
Because nobody wants to willingly concede power.
No, no, they ain't giving it up.
No, it has to be taken. Or it there has to be something that so shocks the conscience, they understand that the ways in which they've held on to power actually threatens our lives. And one of those ways is through law enforcement. I think a lot of people don't understand that our first interactions with law enforcement in this country were our ancestors, right?
Right.
Were being hunted by vigilantes, returning what they called fugitive slaves, but people who were escaping slavery and returning them to their masters. That is the ways in the way in which we began interfacing with then the only law enforcement there was. And unfortunately, far too often, that same storyline has not changed much. We're being hunted.
You make an interesting point when you talk about where the power is. One of the things that I've learned after many years in politics, especially in politics, but also in business, is know where the power is. You have to understand where the power center is in any relationship, in any community. Where's the power center for us? Where's the power center for Black folk right now, do you think?
Mm-hmm. Well, what's so interesting is we have so many power centers, but we also haven't realized them, meaning we have the potential,
mm-hmm.
We have the numbers, but we don't have the collective and the necessary unified strength behind it. So, for example, economically, our power is in our spend. We have been conditioned to believe that it's all consumerism. That is how we are dealt with. That's how we are talked to. And as a result, that's how we engage. And so our buying power now is $1.3 trillion annually.
Right.
Imagine what we could do with that buying power if we turned it inward into investing and into supporting entities within our own communities. We know the dollar doesn't even turn over one time in the Black community before it's out somewhere else.
Right, exactly.
When we look at our political power, that's a place where I feel like we've harnessed the most collective power. You might disagree.
No, I don't. No. Actually, well, I don't disagree. I don't. You know why? Because I see, mm-hmm. I've worked with and dealt with and have myself been a part of that power center, if you will, you know, of elected Black officials. I mean, hell, we've had a Black president. And yet I think in the political space, in more than anything else, it's where it seems to be not as well structured to maximize the economic, the social spaces where, and obviously, you know, the other sort of the community related spaces in a way that we can take advantage of it. I look at it this way. Everybody's running around, Angela, talking about, oh yeah, you know, by 2043, we're going to be a majority minority country. And you know what my response mm-hmm. to that is? Yes, we will be mm-hmm. called South Africa because mm-hmm. we won't have the money and we won't have the power. No matter how you cut this thing up, you combine the Hispanics, the Asians, and Black folk, they still ain't going to control those centers of power related to where the money goes, who spends it, and where the ultimate power goes, which is the decision to spend that money and put it in communities, et cetera, into the things that matter. So that's for me, for most of my adult life, has been one of my salient points. I used to get into arguments all the time with members of the Black Caucus because I would challenge them, saying, what the hell are you doing? How are you leveraging this power? You have it. You can control it. And I can't tell you, even to this day, right now, as I'm looking at Stimulus 4, right?
Yeah.
We didn't get the PPP, baby, but that didn't happen to us. And I'm telling people, I'm like, why? We've got all this power in elected positions and we can't leverage it to make sure that that paycheck reaches all the way down? I don't know. Yeah, I mean, that's why I'm asking. So tell me, how do we, where do we go with this?
Well, and here's what I think that this unfortunate, devastating moment that we find ourselves in offers us. So we were talking about the political piece. And the reason why I said you may disagree is because I think just given the way that power works in this country, Black people have aligned historically with one party or another.
That, right.
I think there was one year, I was actually just reading a political science piece from like 1968, but I can't remember what the exact year was, where the author talked about how it hasn't been since the 40s where Black people were divided evenly in each party.
True.
So, you know, there's one power base, and when all of your political power is with one party, even if it's because overall that party's priorities are in alignment with yours,
right,
your leverage is not really there.
Exactly.
And we see it time and time again with what both parties will do, what kind of hoops they jump through for middle America, blue collar, white voters.
Right.
Democrats have not had those voters for 40 years, and they will still spend millions of dollars trying to get them on a pipe dream. Like, it is the craziest thing. And so here we are like, well, we're your most loyal voting bloc. Why aren't you investing in us? And it's like, oh, because you're our most loyal voting bloc.
Right.
And we're like, yeah, so you should reward us for it. And they're like, no, because you're going to be here. And we're like, no, we don't have to stay. And they're like, prove it.
Where are you going to go, right? That's the response. I've heard it.
Yeah.
So where are you going to go? You're going to go back to the guys who don't want you?
Exactly. And you can speak to that from a leadership perspective.
Yes.
I've used you as an example a lot of times, just saying like, I don't agree with this, but the fire Pelosi idea was your brainchild under the party that you ran. And yep. Then in response to you coming up with a campaign theme, frankly, that stuck, they rewarded you by firing you.
Exactly.
Right. It's like, so Black people ain't safe anywhere. Like,
no.
We're not safe anywhere.
And that's
we need to have our own thing, Michael. It's like, we really need to understand that regardless of where you politically lean, we still have to have a home.
Yes.
We don't have a home. And it's because we're afraid of developing that home. I'm not talking about people going out and doing anything crazy, but it's like, we can't even think about making demands of a candidate without people being like, how dare you do that? That's going to support Trump. No, it's not. It's actually going to help you. It actually will help you. And I keep going back to this. I know you did not ask for the speech, but there's this poster that my dad's friend, Tony Orange, who was like an uncle to me, he actually just mm-hmm. passed away. But right after the ANC election that Nelson Mandela won, he brought this poster over framed, and I used to stare up eating meals at this poster and being like, Dad, if this is democracy, what do we have? Because it was all of these parties. Michael, they had a soccer party mm-hmm. in South Africa.
Yep.
They had a labor party. They had a women's, I mean, like all of these different parties. And I was like, that's not what we have. And my dad is like, yeah, we maybe have three. I'm like, that's not democracy. This looks like democracy. I could join something if I like cereal. I could join, you know what I mean? Like, you're all of these things.
Right.
And it doesn't mean that you won't align. Everybody will, you know, get on board with the candidate that represents the best interests of a country. But we don't have that. We always want to talk about a melting pot, or I don't really like that type of blurring of
right.
of differentness. So I say like jambalaya is a pot. But we don't like that. We don't like to reward difference here. we like to make things colorblind and safe. And anyway, that's a whole book.
Well, but it is a whole book, but it's also you actually opening this conversation this way for me is vastly more important than the way it otherwise could have opened. And the reason is you've got to pull back and get to the nub of why things look and feel and are the way they are. And, you know, I get a lot of the stuff that's happening on the street, you know, and I know where that's coming from. I remember the day King was killed. I remember the riots. I remember my neighborhood getting hit hard and places caught on fire. I remember all of that and was in that. But I also remember my mother telling me that I could do something about it. I could make something happen. I could be a part of something that expands the opportunity for folks in America. And that kind of animated my spirit in a lot of ways. And, you know, folks, you know, look, why are you Republican? All that stuff. I said, well, you know, that's I look at it historically. That's where we grew up, right? That's where it all started in many respects. But that's if you just landlock yourself in such a way that's all you see and that's all you know, then when the change that is needed is necessary and it's time to do it, you can't move, and that's the problem. As America's as diversified, Trump and a whole lot of white folks is stuck on an America that never existed. That's the thing that, you know, that they look at, you know, I heard someone talk the other day about the 1950s.
How didn't it exist, Michael?
Huh?
How didn't it exist? It existed.
No, it wasn't picket fences and, you know, drive-in movies. I mean, that's this sort of idealized America, because even for white folks, it wasn't necessarily like that. So they've got this image that they want to relate back to. We know what it was like for black folks. That's when we hear people talking about, yeah, you know, we want to go to the good old days. Like, no, we don't.
And they said during the 2016 election that good old days to them were in the 1950s. And I was like, okay, so is it an accident or not that was before integration?
There you go. That's
right. Like, right. That's the thing. And so I mean, I've always wanted to know. I've never asked you. I know this is your podcast.
No,
and maybe
go.
This should be on mine, but I've always wanted to know, like, why were you a Republican? And it's not because I think that there's, you know, it's to chastise you. It really is. I'm fascinated to know, you know, what you saw over there. Did you see greater opportunity? Did you see the line was shorter, which is something that's said often about black folks in the Republican Party? Did you see Dr. Arthur Fletcher, who was a mentor of my dad's, and thought that was the path? Like, well, what was the thing
Art
that
was a,
drew
he was, you? He was a mentor of mine. Art Fletcher was a mentor of mine for me as well. So my short answer is my mama raised me well. And what I mean by that is, relating back to the story I just shared, despite all of those difficulties and all of the crap, look, when I was a kid, my mom couldn't take me down to certain parks. I couldn't go to LaDroit Park. I couldn't go to a bunch of places in D.C. because it was still for white only. We were just coming on the other side of integration when I was coming of a young age. And certainly by the time King died, that's when all the wheels started coming off and the change was rapid fire. But the reality of it is, for at least the early portion of my life, I know what those restrictions were like. And my mother shared those experiences and stories with me. And so as I got older, and I remember going to her and I said you know, getting ready to vote. This was the 76 election, my first election. And I was like, hey, going to go vote. And I said, I don't know if I want to register as a Democrat. And she was like, well, I'm not telling you to register as a Democrat. She said, well, you should go out and learn for yourself. So I said, okay. So I went out and I learned. I looked at both parties. And what I realized was the Republican Party was our political home. That's where we began. Frederick Douglass had as much a hand in forming the Republican Party as any white man did. And there were all of these African Americans who later would come on, become the first black senator, the first black congressman, the first black this and that, who were anchored in the party. And coming out of that experience of slavery, the party actually was formed over the disagreement. And those that created this thing we know now as the GOP stood for that individual right and liberty and freedom and actually argued the Constitution, despite the condition that we as a country were in. There was this ideal. And so that appealed to me. And I've always, that's why I call myself a Lincoln Republican. I'm not just a Republican. I'm a Lincoln Republican for the reasons that go to the idea of what was set out in our founding documents. Now, some people call me stupid for believing
that don't apply to you that didn't apply to
that didn't apply to me, but they do now. And that's the genius of the work, because it very easily could have been crafted to say that all white men are created equal. Very easily. And they didn't have to put in a 13th, 14th and 15th Amendment. They didn't have to put in a 19th Amendment. But it spoke to the viability of the ideal. And it's one of the great stories, I think, of this republic, certainly, but of democracy around the globe, that despite all of the ugly underpinnings of its founding, that its founding document says something that is the exact opposite of what was happening on the street, if you will. And so that was appealing to me. And I've been, you know, distressed and beyond compare to what's happened since then in many respects. But it's from that standpoint, for me, these ideas matter. And going to the point you made a little bit before, being able to leverage as a black man in the other party, and to be able to bring that to the table in a way in which I can work with another African-American who's in the other party, and we can leverage our collective opportunities in a way to push up against the system when we have to.
Like, we know black people overwhelmingly switched over from the Republican Party, I think, in the 30s to vote for FDR. And then there was like another kind of a mass exodus for JFK.
Right.
And then after the passing of the 64 Civil Rights Act, the 1965 Voting Rights Act, the Fair Housing Act, like
68, that kind of like 68, right. 68 changed the game. 68 was when it all came to nest the way it has, when Nixon said, hey, Southern Strategy, we're going to go after the disaffected white conservative vote in the South, which was Democratic. Because the North was Republican, the South was Democratic. Today it's, you know, almost it's the reverse. But Democrats moved all when Johnson made the decision to follow along with Kennedy, and honor his legacy with the passage of civil rights. And I mean, because he was himself a segregationist, he was no fan of black folks. But the reality of it was, when he did that, Bubba said, hell no, I'm getting the hell out of here. This ain't for me. Nixon saw that and said, this is how we lock down national elections into the future. And he was right.
And then you started voting with Bubba.
Well, we all did, because we were winning. We all did, right? That was the political calculation. I would say today it was a miscalculation, which is why when I became national chairman, one of the first pronouncements I made was the Southern Strategy is dead. We ain't doing that no more. We're opening up a whole new avenue of conversation, and we're going to look at our politics very differently. Well, I should have known better, because that, coupled with messing with their money, white folks are like, nah, this is not how this goes. But this, all of this is backdrop to the core narrative of what we see playing out on the streets, which is the point I think you raised very appropriately. Is how do you then take all of this and garner power from it that you can use to leverage your political, your economic, your social history, opportunities, et cetera? How do you do that? Because we're not on that page. I want to have that meeting where we're all in space together and we're saying, this is us. We get to define us for the first time in 401 years. Not the white man. He's the one who's labeled us nigga. He's the one who's labeled us Negro. He's the one who's labeled us black. He's the one who's done all this. And the one time we come up with a name for ourselves, African American, they got pissed off. Mm-hmm. Well, why would you want to put those together? So what is it we do? What is it we have to do to honor the memory of Floyd, Aubrey, Taylor? Mm-hmm. Well, how do
And today, I posted about a young man who was shot, and or not shot, but was also strangled to death. He also said, "I can't breathe." Manuel Ellis in Tacoma, Washington, in my home state. And so when you just think about that and the fact that this storyline is not new, that before George Floyd and Manuel Ellis, it was Eric Garner. You know, it's just like the story just keeps continuing. And I just hope that what we will see is that we have the power to sit down, to figure it out, to strategize, to push people to do right. But we also need to push people to do right. Everybody who's calling us right now, asking us what to do, asking us where to donate, asking us where to give. We also need to be having conversations about what corporate boards should look like and what their mm-hmm. vendor utilization programs look like mm-hmm. and what their C-suites look like and what are their job training programs look like. This is a interest conversation. It should not be about the CBC talks about all the time. No permanent friends, no permanent enemies, just permanent interest. This is an interest in surviving conversation. Economic survival, political survival, psychological survival, emotional survival, spiritual survival. I mean, surviving, right?
Right.
And that means we have to be willing to have a candid conversation with reasonable Black minds, because there are some folks in your party who I will never talk to, who would blame George Floyd for his own death.
Yes, yes, yes.
You know,
I know exactly. Yep. Yep.
Yeah, we can't engage there, but we can have a willing conversation about, okay, maybe we've all made some political miscalculations. Now, what do we do to reset to get this right? Because this is exactly that. It should not be a partisan issue to take on white supremacy. It should not be a partisan issue to see the overall advancement of Black people. That should be something that is clearly in our collective interest, and any willing party, ally, co-conspirator, collaborator, partner, whatever, it should be, we should all be able to align on those things.
We're talking to Angela Rye. She's a CNN political commentator, but she's a hell of a lot more than that. And I'm glad that she is on the podcast. We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to have a little bit more. We're going to talk about something that Malcolm said right after this.
Everyone loses golf balls, even the pros. When you need golf balls, go to LostGolfBalls.com, the world's largest inventory of used golf balls. All the top brands in stock, 50% off retail. LostGolfBalls.com.
All right, everybody, we are back, and we're talking to Angela Rye, CEO of Impact Strategies, and definitely catch her out on her podcast, On One with Angela Rye. Angela,
It's On One, Michael.
Huh?
It's On One.
Yeah, On One.
On One. I thought you said One One.
No,
sorry,
no, I got you covered. Come on, sister. Jack, wait a minute. You think I'm gonna misstep like that? No.
Well, you know, I just wanted to make sure that you heard that I was always On One.
Well, so you are always on one. We know that. It's On One with Angela Rye. That's it.
So, sorry, man.
No, I appreciate the correction. I know if the sister's gonna make you get it right, so that's the bottom line. I grew up in the matriarchal system. I get it.
I love that. That's great.
So I tweeted out, it was hysterical, a quote from Malcolm X this week, and on everybody was like, oh my God, the seventh sign, Michael Steele just quoted Malcolm X. Little do they know, I've been quoting Malcolm X since I was in my 20s, but we don't need to get into that. One of the things that he said was this, quote, "That's not a chip on my shoulder. That's your foot on my neck."
Mm-hmm.
He said that back in 1965, people. And here we are on May 25th, watching for 9 minutes, a white police officer with his knee on the neck of George Floyd. at the memorial service, Reverend Al Sharpton, who's a friend and colleague over at MSNBC, giving the eulogy, noted, and I'm going to paraphrase here because the important part was this. We could achieve as black people, but you had your knee on our neck. And it spoke to so much of what that struggle has been. If you want to try to contextualize for the rest of the country what that experience has been, that framing for me by Malcolm and Al really works. It's a visual, it's an auditory thing. You can hear it and go, wow, you feel it. I could have a better education, but you had your knee on my neck. I could succeed at whatever I wanted to be, but you had your knee on my neck. How do we take that and again, going back to what we were just talking about, use that as a motivator within our own community to see we can't give up on this. Now the struggle is getting that knee off our neck. Now that we figured out what it is, you know, how do we go about doing that? And black women, I want to focus on black women because you're a good example of this, have figured out how to begin to carve that space out in a way that it's taking notice. It's showing power, it's showing influence, it's showing connectivity in a way that we haven't seen in a long, long time. In the 60s, it was the black men, it was the Malcolms, the Martins, and so forth, who kind of got the stage. But today, it's women like yourself, and certainly, you know, the women who have been leading, like Condoleezza Rice on the right, and Michelle Obama. What's happening in that space? Is it the women who are helping us take that knee off the neck, or what? What's going on there?
I think Stacey Abrams,
for example, just throw another name out there.
Yes, Kamala. I don't know if you saw Kamala Harris's press conference speech the other day when they were talking about, what she and Corey are doing. Like, yes, I think that women have always been an important part of leading and strategizing around the movement. And I think that now you're starting to see recognition for it. Like, now it's okay for women to be in leadership positions, whereas, you know, back in the day, not even that long ago, in 2016, there were some black people that said Hillary could not be the president because a woman couldn't even be the pastor of a church, right? Like, that's the truth.
That's the truth.
I think that what you're starting to see now is that people are accepting that women sometimes are the most amazing leaders, most times.
Right.
And then what's so ironic about the very thought that black people in particular would have any issue with women leadership is black women have been leading households since we arrived on the shores.
I was going to say for about at least 396 years.
I mean, yes. And I mean, it's not by choice. It's because families were separated, right? That is our natural disposition. I think that what we have to acknowledge, like going back to this analogy of the foot on the neck or the knee on the neck, when you take a moment to just reimagine that picture of that officer's knee on the neck of George Floyd, you sense the pressure in your chest and the heaviness of that moment and the weight of oppression for 401 years. It is the picture version of what the black experience in this country has been. And I think that when people start to make that connection, that is when we will see change, right? Like people haven't, the reason why like people are connecting with George Floyd so much more is not because he's any more or less human than all the other victims, Michael, we're in quarantine. Mm-hmm. We're in safer in place. We're stuck at home. People can't turn this off. They can't turn away from it. And because they can't turn away from it, they have to deal with their shit.
Yep.
I'm sorry.
No,
that's not your
problem. No, that's all right.
But that is what it is. It's like you have to deal with the ugliness of the reality that, yes, your great experience in that school you went to that may not have been the thing that got you that job. It could have been your white privilege. It could be the years and years of a head start that you had over your black counterpart. It could be the fact that, you know, you have a better home because you were not saddled in student debt graduating from college. Like all of these things. Yes, your parent survived over my parent with coronavirus because your hospital is better. Mm-hmm. Your kid got into better schools because your school system with the property taxes in that area are better. We were never on equal playing field. We were never on equal footing. And that is like, we talk about your mentor and my dad's mentor, Dr. Fletcher. The reason he was the father of affirmative action is because he knew that.
That's right.
Because he had the foresight to say, I know that we're going to have to level this off. People could complain and say it wasn't sufficient, it wasn't right, whatever. But like Bill Clinton said in the 90s, it's amend it, then don't end it, right?
Right.
It's amend it, don't end it. We need to figure out a way very quickly to get to equity in this country. And that means radical shifts in policy. It really does. So I hope that.
Go ahead. Mm-hmm. No, finish your point.
I was going to say, even while, you know, we're talking about Kamala and Corey and these radical shifts in policing, I want to see Tim Scott there. Yeah. You know, every now and then he'll show up. He did it for the anti-lynching bill. He needs to show up for what is modern day lynching. He needs to be partnered with them on that effort. He needs to be pushing his colleagues on the other side of the aisle to do the right thing, to stop calling these people protesting because they want to save the next life. Thugs. We have to get away from that. He cannot protect them. It is dangerous.
No, it is. But that gets into the politics. And the politics has been so poisoned under the leadership of Trump. The emasculation of that elephant, if you will, and the condensing of all of the ideology, if you will, into a moment that we saw this week, this past Tuesday or so, mm-hmm. when the president decided that he didn't like the storyline about the bunker and wanted to walk across mm-hmm. Lafayette Park. And mm-hmm. so what happened? You have the police tear gas and pelt people with rubber bullets to clear them out so he could walk across, stand in front of St. John's Episcopal Church, and hold a Bible.
Mm-hmm. With his thumb out like Hitler had the Bible.
Thank you. You noticed that too.
Mm-hmm. Well, I didn't do it by myself. Somebody posted it on social media and I was like, mm-hmm.
So, but here's the thing. And this is how you know the sucking the life out of whatever was left of the GOP as we knew it was when you watched the day after senators going to their meeting, Republican senators, not one stopping in front of the bank of cameras. When asked, did the president do the right thing? So the pressure inside that bubble apparently is so great. Now, I've been in that room. I was in that room for 2 years. Every Tuesday I had lunch with these guys and I watched it. And there came a point where it was very clear they were tired of me because I was coming in giving the political. So I'm like, hey, this is what we're doing out here. We've got this network. We're growing this. But I need you guys to get on this page. You got to give me something to work with on this healthcare piece, because it ain't enough to go out and say, well, Barack Obama this and Barack Obama that. Right. Mm-hmm. No, it was you could just see where they were going. So I do my thing and we did. That's why I tell people it wasn't fire Obama. It was fire Pelosi, you know, because that's where the power was. It wasn't where people thought it was. But anyway, the reality mm-hmm. of it is for someone like Tim, it's hard for him to get outside of that. Because he's going to walk that same line that all those other senators walk. And that's the problem that I have right now with the leadership in the party. Because if you're not going to die on the hill in this moment, tell me what moment you will. Because it can't get much harder and much more difficult than what we're going through right now. And if you can't stand up and say, damn it, this is not leadership. That's why, Mr. Mattis coming out in the last 24 hours, and even the Secretary of Defense kind of said, well, look, I have to backtrack because, man, this is not where we're going in the Defense Department. We're not using the military this way. We need more of that, but it's not there on my side. It just isn't. It hasn't been. And I don't think it will. But I can tell you this. Let me just give you a little answer. You know what's going to happen, Angela? Let's say Trump loses in November. All these mofos gonna be running around going, Trump who? Trump who?
Oh, I'm clear.
They gonna be acting like the last 4 years, that shit did not happen. Trust me, yeah. I know them. And they're gonna be all up in your face. So, Miss Rock, can I come on your program and talk to you about what we're doing in the black community?
No, you can't, especially because I'm like, do you know how dangerous?
That's it.
He is so dangerous. Like there's a video Bill Kristol posted the other day, like a little ad, and I need to send this to you if you haven't seen it. But I was like, my response to this on Twitter was like, we tried to tell y'all, and I was like, well, Bill, you already knew. I remember being on TV with Bill Kristol, and he was flipping out about Donald Trump. Like flipping out. Yeah. And I was like, I never thought we were around with Jake on Jake together. I was like, I never thought I'd agree with you. And we started laughing because it was just like I was like, well, Bill said it. Like, I don't really have.
I really need to add. Right. Mm-mm. So when I say to you law and order, what do you think? What do you hear when I say I am the law and order president?
I hear that your foot or your knee or your elbow is on my neck. Mm-hmm. I see in my mind an image of Rodney King. I see in my mind the vigilante that chased down Trayvon and the vigilantes that chased down Ahmaud Arbery. I see in my mind the police officers that executed a no-knock warrant and killed Breonna Taylor. I see in my mind the white woman, Amber Gregor, that killed Botham Jean. Mm-hmm. Right. Like I see like instance after instance where white supremacy has elevated itself over black people and to our detriment. Law and order is not a system that protects and serves us. It is one that shoots to kill us far too often. Law and order does not serve black people.
I wanted that out there because I think it's important for white listeners to understand what we hear. Mm-hmm. And I don't think they do. They think we hear the same thing they hear. They think we should hear the same thing they hear. You know, it's like when we become the head of these institutions that they've held. And I had this experience inside the RNC, and I damn sure know Barack Obama had it at the White House. They expect us to be white. They expect us to think white. And they expect us to express and hear and feel and move the way they would. So when they hear, you know, when you say law and order, it's like, okay, yes, you know, we're all about the, you know, bringing justice and keeping, you know, the blue line and supporting the police. And I'm like, dude, that's not what I hear. Let me tell you what I hear. I hear my son's nervousness when he comes back home after having been stopped by the cop and nothing happened. But he's still a little bit shaken. He's still a little bit nervous. What I hear is what my experiences have been in this reality. And what we all hear is what you just expressed, Angela. And it's important for people to understand that law and order means something very, very different to people who've been under the law.
Yes, literally.
Right. And ordered to jail. So it's. I just wanted to put that out because I think it's important for people to understand it. Now, before I let you go, because I've taken up a lot of your time, and more than I promised I would, but
That's okay. This has been good.
So I read a great story by Alex Trotner. I think that's how he says his last name. Isaac Trotner. And he's talking about a Black Lives Matter co-founder explains why this time is different. So this is from the perspective of how folks are starting to see these things. And in it, he notes, quote, "What began as a hashtag in response to Trayvon Martin's death became a nationwide phenomenon with protests in response to the killing of African Americans, and chapters across the country grew out of that. Now and after the death of George Floyd, at the hands of a Minneapolis police officer, and a week of nationwide protests to an extent unseen in a half a century, Black Lives Matters is once again in the biggest story of the country. How are these protests different from what came before, and why do you think they are different from what came before?" And it goes into how the response to this death, this crisis, seems more personal, more visceral. How do you see it? Do you see this as something that's really going to be different? Or, I mean, as you just noted, not 10 minutes ago, the death of another person in your home state out in Washington.
Manuel Ellis, yeah. Well, his death, he died March 3rd, but it's just now getting attention.
It's getting attention, and right.
Yep, just like what happened with Ahmaud Arbery.
Yeah.
That was February
23rd, yeah.
Exactly. And so what I feel like is different, hopefully, is that it's just been too many. There have been too many videos. There have been too many hashtags. There have been too many stories. There have been too many instances of body cameras not being on or not working. There have been too many times where the victim, male or female, the person has been attacked after they were killed for drugs in their system or alcohol, or they were erratic, or they were angry, or they were mentally ill. The victim blaming in the situation. There have just been too many times. And so my hope in the middle of, like everybody has been so artfully calling it, this pandemic within a pandemic, my hope is that when people, because I think even with coronavirus, it exposed some racial divides people had turned a blind eye to.
Yeah,
we've been telling people racism exists in the healthcare system and we're disproportionately impacted. And it was almost like people finally started hearing. I was like, why are you hear this now? You know, we've been saying this, and I feel the very same way about Black Lives Matter. Finally, corporations and everybody can say Black Lives Matter, and it's not an argument.
Right.
It's not a damn argument. It is an affirmation. It is a promise that one day our lives, hopefully now today, will mean as much as yours. Yeah. You won't see us as three-fifths. When you say American, you won't just see white. You know, when you say you should hear this the way that I see it, you're not whitewashing our reality, that now maybe you will value that our experience is truly different and that too should change. So I'm hopeful, and I'm really, really hopeful because it was my dad's 78th birthday on June 2nd.
My dad said, "I'm just real quick. My mom's 93rd is coming up on the 12th, so they're in the same bucket." Yeah.
We got Gemini parents. So my dad says on the Zoom call, because of course that's the way we celebrate birthdays these days.
Right.
He said, with all his nieces and nephews and everybody on there, he said, the best birthday present for me has been watching all these young people hitting the streets for their rights.
Wow.
Like that, all my dad wants was for young people to take on the organizing activism mantle, agitating mantle that he is so, long been a part of, and to see them do something in such a huge way. Like there's a day that was bigger than any of the civil rights days, not the length of the movement, just the overall action on one day was bigger than even that. And for him to see that in his lifetime gives him so much hope. And him being that hopeful gave me so much hope. And so I've got to believe that because people were willing to organize and because they were willing to make demands and because we're saying it can get better and it doesn't have to be incremental change, it can be radical. I'm hopeful just from that because we were saying it before this happened. And then when this happened, it was like, see, we told you it was needed. So I'm just hopeful because of that.
Well, we're going to leave it at that. We're going to leave it with that hopeful, that hopefulness from Angela Rye. She is, I'm telling you, folks, I love listening to her and watching her. I'm a huge fan. I look forward to the day when we can get back into having some serious up and down, knock down, drag out policy disputes about healthcare and education and all that good stuff and find that sweet spot where we actually wind up agreeing.
No, you're coming to the black side. We're all going to the black side. We don't know where that is, but we're establishing our own home.
No argument. Let me go pack my bags now.
We gotta go.
This shit is too real to stay here.
That's exactly.
That reminds me of a party I was at once. So I don't need to go into that right now. I turned to a friend and said, "Nah, this shit is too real for me to stay here. It's time to go."
I definitely got that's everybody. Now you know there's a round two on this podcast. We're gonna hear this story.
Angela, thank you so much for being a part of the conversation, and more importantly, making the conversation happen out there every day. Folks, check her out on Twitter at @Angela_Rye. Follow her on Instagram. She's there. The stuff she puts up on Instagram is priceless. Great having you on. That does it for this episode, folks. Keep it real out there. Be safe. Be honest. Don't forget to do that little thing I love you to do, that special voodoo at Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, or wherever you get your podcast on. You know I love it when you do that. Touch me on Twitter at Michael Steele. And remember this, that's not a chip on my shoulder. That's your foot on my neck. Oof. Malcolm taught us that. Live it, learn it. Let's turn it around. Catch y'all next week.
Your local Health Mart pharmacy is putting the personal care back in healthcare. We know you by name, not by refill number. Visit healthmart.com for the location near you. Health Mart, caring for you and about you.
Everyone loses golf balls, even the pros. When you need golf balls, go to lostgolfballs.com, the world's largest inventory of used golf balls. All the top brands, in stock, 50% off retail. lostgolfballs.com.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3-bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort-style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.